and had murdered its architect and master mason, Hiram Abiff. Their names were Jubala, Jubalo, and Jubalum. According to the tradition, the three Jewes had all manner of insidious tortures inflicted on them as punishment and warning, including the removal of their tongues and ritual disembowelment with the intestines thrown over one shoulder. This, of course, recalls the mutilation of some of the Whitechapel victims, particularly with regard to the intestines. However, with all the mayhem, the tongues were not cut out, which would seem to have been just as symbolic and therefore just as important. As far as the intestines are concerned, there was so much mutilation that you could practically connect any historical mutilating torture with it and not be too far off. A significant number of those involved with the case, including Warren and for a brief period Dr. Robert Anderson, were Masons. The conspiracy thinking had it that the murders were part of a vast Masonic plot, and that by erasing the graffito, Warren was attempting to protect his fellow Masons, even if it meant destroying evidence and hampering an investigation. Of course, if we accept that it was a warning, why would he then erase it before anyone could be warned? Either way, the logic is just too messy to make much sense from an investigative analysis perspective. It must be said, however, that the Masonic conspiracy theory continued to grow and become more elaborate until finally it even attached itself to the already established royal family theories. All in all, I tend to agree with the police that the graffito was an incidental finding, not related to the murder. Coincidence that it just happened to be on the wall above the apron? Maybe, maybe not. Graffiti were common in that area, particularly with similar sentiments. The first thing we have to ask is, what the hell does "the Jewes are the men that will not be blamed for nothing" or "the Jewes are not the men that will be blamed for nothing" mean? For the most logical interpretation, I turn to Martin Fido, the prominent British scholar, author, and crime historian, and among the most knowledgeable and resourceful of Ripper investigators. Fido interprets the syntax of the Goulston Street graffito as being characteristic of the Cockney tendency to use double negatives. Fido notes that Goulston Street is right around the corner from Middlesex Street, or Petticoat Lane, the largest Jewish marketplace in London. Connecting the two was Wentworth Street, side of a cheap shoe market. Given anti-Semitism, and that it was well known that one could obtain inexpensive shoes, clothing, and other goods from Jewish merchants, Fido explains that in Cockney dialect, the graffito can be translated into, "the Jews are the men who won't take responsibility for anything," and was probably scrawled by a bigoted and irate, not to mention poor spelling, East Ender, who felt he had been cheated by a Jewish merchant who would not stand behind his product. It would, therefore, be mere happenstance that the angry message was seen right above the bloody apron fragment. If you accept Fido's double negative interpretation, which I do, then why couldn't the message just as easily refer to the Jewes of Freemasonry lore? Why couldn't it hearken to a Masonic conspiracy? Well, for one thing, in 1888 London, the Jewes reference would have been extremely esoteric. According to Fido's research, all references to Jubalo, Jubala, and Jubalum had disappeared from the already highly secretive English Masonic ritual between 1811 and 1815. Anyone who would know something that obscure was not the type who would scrawl it on a tenement entryway, particularly in flight from a bloody and disorganized murder. And as for its being a Masonic warning about the fate that might befall traitors, if you're that secretive, why give yourself away in so crude a manner? No, it just doesn't add up. The victims identified. On the evening of October 1st, the identity of the Berner Street victim was finally known. Notwithstanding Mary Malcolm's identification of her sister Elizabeth Watts Stokes as the dead woman, Mrs. Stokes turned up very much alive. The actual victim was Elizabeth Stride, a 44-year-old émigré from Sweden who was identified by her former husband's nephew, Metropolitan Police Constable Walter Frederick Stride. It is difficult to know what she looked like in life, as the only known photograph of her was taken in the mortuary after death. All of the teeth were missing from her left lower jaw, which indicates she seemed to have lived a life of chronic disease and poverty, as did the other victims. And like the other victims, her marriage had broken down at least a few years before. She gravitated from the grim Whitechapel workhouse to one of the common lodging houses on Flower and Dean Street, then moved to Dorset Street with a laborer named Michael Kidney, who was 7 years her junior. Kidney had a criminal record and was said to have beaten her from time to time. She was known in the neighborhood as Long Liz and had repeatedly been arrested for drunkenness. As closely as the police could reconstruct, Liz Stride was seen at the Queen's Head pub at around 6:30 p.m. on September 29th, then returned to Flower and Dean Street at about 7 p.m. At around 11 p.m., two laborers saw her leaving the Bricklayer's Arms pub on Settle Street between Whitechapel Road and Commercial Road. She was with a man who appeared to them to be very properly British, about 5'5". The two men called out teasingly to Liz to be careful in case her escort was Leather Apron. 45 minutes later, another laborer saw her with apparently the same man on Burner Street. After the couple kissed, the man said to her, "You would say anything but your prayers." 15 minutes after that, fruit merchant Matthew Packer sold a half pound of grapes to a man he believed to be the one others saw with Liz. It was raining, and he noted that the couple stood outside across Burner Street from his shop for almost half an hour. They were still there when Metropolitan Police Constable William Smith noted a couple that matched the other descriptions. Like the previous crimes, this one also gets fuzzy. Dock worker James Brown saw a couple he thought was Liz Stride and her client leaning up against a wall on Fairclough Street. She was saying, "Not tonight, maybe some other night." When Brown saw Stride's body at the mortuary, he stated he was certain that was the woman he had seen. Yet, at the same time, a Hungarian Jewish immigrant named Israel Schwartz was returning to the International Working Men's Club on Burner Street when he thought he saw a man throwing Liz Stride to the ground. He crossed the street, at which point the man shouted "Lipsky" at him, an anti-Semitic epithet referring to a Jewish murderer who had recently been hanged. Schwartz said he noticed another man nearby lighting his pipe and, fearful of being mugged, ran away. He gave a complete account to the police, and when he was taken to Stride's body in the mortuary, he also identified her as the woman he had seen. It was only about 15 minutes after Schwartz's encounter that Louis Diemschutz encountered the body in approximately the same place. Was it, in fact, Elizabeth Stride that Schwartz had seen? If so, was she killed by the man who threw her down? Or did she get away from him, only to be fatally attacked by another? Could this person have been the second man Schwartz saw lighting his pipe? Perhaps that man and the one who threw Liz down had nothing to do with each other. In any event, neither of them matched the description of the man and the couple Constable Smith had seen 15 minutes earlier. When you can't resolve conflicting witness statements, and it happens with great regularity, you try to put them all in the back of your mind and move on with other evidence, forensic or behavioral, that seems more solid and reliable. Then, if any other lead opens up, you can go back to what the witnesses thought they saw and see if any of it fits in. The Mitre Square victim was identified with less difficulty than Elizabeth Stride. She was wearing and carrying all of her worldly possessions, and among them was a mustard tin containing 2 pawn tickets. One of them was in the name of Anne Kelly, close to the name Mary Ann Kelly, given by a woman who had been picked up drunk on the pavement at 8:30 Saturday night and taken to Bishopsgate Police Station to sleep it off. The following Tuesday, an unemployed market porter named John Kelly went to the police, fearing that the pawn tickets belonged to his common-law wife, Catherine Kelly, also known as Catherine Conway, whose first husband had been a soldier named Thomas Conway. The victim turned out to be the woman Kelly feared, though the name she was most commonly known by was her nickname, Kate, and her own maiden name, Eddowes. In a pathetic replay of earlier victims, Conway had left her 8 years before over her drinking. She and Kelly, though desperately poor, apparently got on well together. They had just gotten back on Thursday from a trip to Kent, where they had been paid for picking hops, something like migrant farm labor. This was a common activity for EastEnders. It got them out into the fresh air while giving them a little money for their efforts. When Kate and Kelly had returned, still nearly broke, they spent a night together at the Shoe Lane workhouse, where she was well known. On Friday, Kate gave Kelly a few pennies to stay at a doss house on Flower and Dean Street, while she went to the Mile End workhouse to try to squeeze out another night before they'd put her to work. On Saturday, she met Kelly back at Shoe Lane and took a pair of his boots to pawn, receiving 2 shillings and 6 pence. The couple used the money to buy groceries and have breakfast, and then, broke again, Kate went to try to find her daughter to borrow money, but couldn't find her. The next time she was accounted for was that evening, when City Police Constable Lewis Robinson found her lying drunk on the pavement. When she couldn't stand up on her own, that's how she ended up at Bishopsgate Police Station. She woke up about 12:30 and asked to be released. Constable George Hutt promised to let her go when she was capable, finally opening the door for her at 1 a.m., when he thought it would be too late for her to get any more to drink. "I shall get a damned fine hiding when I get home," she said, testifying to the domestic violence that was rampant then. At about 1:35 a.m., Joseph Lewendy, a cigarette salesman, Harry Harris, a furniture dealer, and Joseph Levy, a butcher, believe they saw Kate Eddowes at one of the entrances to Mitre Square, talking amicably to a man. But none of the three of them saw her face, only what she was wearing. That was the last sighting of Catherine Eddowes, alive. Linkage. Now, the first thing we have to ask ourselves as profilers is, were the two murders of the double event related? The initial response would be yes, but before we jump to conclusions, let's look at the behavioral evidence. The crimes were committed within a 12-minute walk of each other, within about a 20 to 30-minute period. The victimology was similar in both cases. What are the chances that there would be two lust killers operating in the same area at the same time, with virtually the same modus operandi, or MO? I used to get asked that kind of question quite frequently by detectives, and then later on if I testified in court, trying to link several cases together to show a pattern of behavior. We were able to argue this quite successfully in the 1993 trial of Cleophas Prince, Jr., accused of murdering 6 women in San Diego. We felt Prince was extremely dangerous, and if the prosecution could prove he was guilty of all 6 murders, rather than merely the one they had solid DNA evidence on, then this would qualify under California law as special circumstances, which would make it a capital case. If that could be established, then there'd be no chance of Prince's getting out on the street again to wreak more human destruction. By showing the similarity of victimology, modus operandi, signature elements, weapons, and locations, we showed the jury how it was beyond reason that 2 or more different offenders who happened to have identical behavioral traits could be operating in the same San Diego area at the same time. But is that what we're talking about here in the double event in Whitechapel? What are the chances of 2 lust killers operating at the same time and place? Well, we have a couple of issues to consider. In the first place, Stride's throat was cut, and there was deep bruising on her face and neck, but she was not mutilated in the same way as Nichols, Chapman, and Eddowes. According to the terminology we would use at Quantico, the M.O. is the same, but the signature appears to be different. M.O. and signature are 2 of the most important terms we deal with. Both are used in evaluating behavior and tracking unsubs. But they're 2 distinct aspects of a crime. M.O. refers to the techniques the offender employs to commit the crime. Signature refers to the elements not necessary to carry out the crime, but what the offender has to do to satisfy his emotional needs. If a bank robber tapes over the lens of a surveillance camera, that's M.O. If he feels a need to tear his clothes off and dance naked before that same camera, that's signature. It doesn't help him commit the crime. In fact, in this case, it hurts him. But it's something he has to do to make the experience emotionally satisfying. Let's take a more serious example in these 2 elements, and we can get it right from the Whitechapel murders. The killer blitz-attacked Annie Chapman because that's what he thought he had to do to neutralize her so he could commit murder. But then when the murder's been accomplished, the victim dead, he needs to mutilate her. This is very much what we refer to as a signature crime. The murder is not a means to an end, such as robbery or political statement. It is done so the offender can rip her up to satisfy his psychosexual needs. Okay, then, is there a reasonable way of explaining this divergence of signatures between Stride and the previous 3 victims? Sure there is. His name is Louis Diemschutz. A logical reason why the unsub did not butcher Liz Stride after he'd killed her is that Deemshutz surprised him, and he had to flee before his work was completed. But then his bloodlust was not sated, so he had to go find another woman, a vulnerable prostitute, to mutilate. This next time, with Kate Eddowes, he had his way. In fact, maybe he had so much time that he actually wrote a cryptic message on the wall of Goulston Street for his pursuers to find and interpret. This is good criminological analysis so far, but we've got another issue, one potentially more serious than the divergence of signature elements. It is clear from the post-mortem examination of Elizabeth Stride that she was killed with a short-bladed knife, not a long-bladed one as was obviously used on Nichols and Chapman. Maybe this isn't a problem. The killer would likely own more than one knife, particularly if he was in either the livestock or the leather trade. But from a crime analysis perspective, this is a problem. Why? Because Catherine Eddowes was also killed with a long-bladed knife. If the short knife had been used on the second victim of the evening, whether or not it was used on the first, we wouldn't have a linkage problem. That would mean either that the unsub had simply changed knives for whatever reasons of M.O., or that after the first killing, he thought he could be traced by the long knife and had better switch to another one. But as it is, the long knife is used slightly later in the evening on Eddowes, referring us straight back to Nichols and Chapman, but not necessarily to Stride. Could this mean there was another killer out that night? It could. In fact, a number of ripperologists think that it does. Maybe it was a copycat. But so close, in time and place? Wouldn't it be awfully coincidental that the copycat struck, and then less than half an hour later the original killer struck close by? Yes, coincidences do happen in this business, but I think it is highly unlikely. Based on the victimology, the M.O., and the location, I would advise the Metropolitan and City Police to link the Stride murder with the three, and possibly four, others. But then what's the behavioral answer for the use of the short knife with Stride? I don't know. It doesn't add up. Did the unsub take two knives with him on a whim, then, when he killed Elizabeth Stride, decide that the short one didn't work as well? Could be. This is not an exact science. People, criminals included, do all sorts of things for no particular conscious reason, and this is difficult to factor into your analysis. From my experience, every major case seems to have loose ends. If you're a detective or a profiler, you get used to this ambiguity. You don't like it, but you learn to live with it. Dear Boss, if the Annie Chapman murder sent the East End into a spasm of terror, the Liz Stride and Kate Eddowes killings sent all of London into paroxysms. And now, the evil finally had a name. By Monday, October 1st, the world became aware of the contents of two communications, a letter and a postcard, mailed 4 days apart from two separate locations in East London to the Central News Agency and reprinted in the Morning Daily News and Evening Star. By that point, they'd already been forwarded to Scotland Yard for analysis, and the police would disseminate them on their own with the expectation that someone would recognize the wording or handwriting and come forward. The letter, written in red ink and crayon, with a flowing, proper-looking handwriting, read, 25 September, 1888. Dear Boss, I keep on hearing the police have caught me, but they won't fix me just yet. I have laughed when they look so clever and talk about being on the right track. That joke about leather apron gave me real fits. I am down on whores, and I shan't quit ripping them till I do get buckled. Grand work the last job was. I gave the lady no time to squeal. How can they catch me now? I love my work, and want to start again. You will soon hear of me with my funny little games. I saved some of the proper red stuff in a ginger beer bottle over the last job to write with, but it went thick like glue and I can't use it. Red ink is fit enough, I hope, ha, ha. The next job I do, I shall clip the lady's ears off and send to the police officers just for jolly, wouldn't you? Keep this letter back till I do a bit more work, then give it out straight. My knife's so nice and sharp, I want to get to work right away if I get a chance. Good luck. Yours truly, Jack the Ripper. Don't mind me giving the trade name. There was a second postscript attached sideways, and this was the part written in red crayon. Wasn't good enough to post this before I get all the red ink off my hands, curse it. No luck yet. They say I'm a doctor now, ha ha. This became known forevermore as the Dear Boss letter, and the first appearance of Jack the Ripper, a name that quickly superseded the Whitechapel murderer in public dialogue and private nightmare. The other communication, referred to as the Saucy Jackie postcard, was also written in crayon and read, I was not coddling dear old boss when I gave you the tip. You'll hear about Saucy Jackie's work tomorrow, double event this time. Number one squealed a bit, couldn't finish straight off. Had not time to get ears for police. Thanks for keeping last letter back till I got to work again. Jack the Ripper. So the phantom monster had finally communicated with the world and given out his blood-curdling name. Or had he? Let me say here that although the police were immediately suspicious of the communications, many ripperologists, after careful consideration, continue to believe that the Dear Boss letter and Saucy Jackie postcard are authentic. After some analysis of my own, I go with Scotland Yard and believe them to be fakes. The process we use to evaluate communications from unsubs, such as ransom notes and letters to the police, is known as psycholinguistic analysis. It is not a handwriting analysis. We can get other experts to do that for us when we think we need it, but rather stresses the actual use of language, the style, and, of course, the underlying message. Of all the self-styled Jack the Ripper copycats over the years, perhaps the most famous and notorious was the so-called Yorkshire Ripper, who bludgeoned and stabbed women, mostly prostitutes, in the north of England from 1975 through 1980. There had been 8 deaths, 3 other women had escaped, and the case had become the largest manhunt in the history of British law enforcement when I happened to be in England to teach a course at the Bramshill Police Academy, their equivalent to Quantico, about an hour outside London. The police had already conducted literally tens of thousands of interviews. As might be expected in a case of this enormity, both the police and the media had received a number of letters purporting to be from the Ripper. They were all evaluated, but I don't think the police placed much evidentiary value on any of them. But then a 2-minute tape cassette arrived by mail to Chief Inspector George Oldfield, taunting the police and promising to strike again. Just as the Dear Boss letter had been reprinted in newspapers throughout England, the Oldfield tape was played everywhere, on television and radio, on toll-free telephone numbers, even over the PA systems at soccer matches, in the hope that someone would recognize the voice and identify the unsub. I'd heard a copy of the tape back at Quantico, and after classes at Bramshill one evening, they asked me what I thought. I asked them to describe the scenes to me. It seemed the unsub maneuvered to get his female victims into a vulnerable position, then, like the Whitechapel murderer, he'd blitz-attack them, in this case with a knife or hammer. And, as in Whitechapel, he'd mutilate them after death. I thought the voice on the tape was pretty articulate and sophisticated for someone who got his ultimate satisfaction out of life from killing and mutilating prostitutes. So I said, based on the crime scenes you've described and this audio tape I heard back in the States, that's not the Ripper. You're wasting your time with that. In my business, it is extremely important to be able to evaluate any and all behavioral clues so that the police do not waste their time and always limited resources. With a serial offender, wasted time equals wasted lives. The actual perpetrator of these crimes would not communicate with the police in this fashion. He'd be an almost invisible loner in his late 20s or early 30s, with a pathological hatred of women, a school dropout, and possibly a truck driver, since he seemed to get around the countryside quite a bit. When 35-year-old truck driver Peter Sutcliffe was arrested on a fluke on January 2, 1981, then admitted and was proved to be the Yorkshire Ripper, He bore little resemblance to the individual who had made and sent the tape. The imposter turned out to be a retired policeman who had a grudge against Inspector Oldfield. I suspect something similar was going on with the Dear Boss letter, but the letter is clever and legitimate enough that it has led on a lot of people for over 100 years. So, like the Oldfield tape, I believe it had to be forged by someone who knew how the game was played. The most likely candidate would be a reporter, a conclusion we can arrive at from several directions. First, the boss referred to is not the boss of the police, but the boss of the central news agency. While it would not be unusual for a certain type of sexually oriented predator to communicate with the press, to blow his own horn and let the world know how he thinks of himself and what he wants to be called, we would expect this communication to be with an individual newspaper. We know, for example, that both the Star and News, among many other papers, were publishing regular and lurid details of the Whitechapel murders. On the other hand, it takes a fair amount of sophistication for an offender not associated with the business of journalism even to realize that a news agency exists that supplies the various papers. This type of insider information would be particularly beyond the range of the type of largely disorganized, emotionally deficient individual that the behavioral clues had shown this killer to be. This is further underscored, in my opinion, by the use of language in the letter. Psycholinguistically speaking, the Dear Boss letter is a performance, a characterization by a literate, articulate person of what a crazed killer should sound like. It's too organized, too indicative of intelligence and rational thought, and far too cutesy. I don't believe an offender of this type would ever think of his actions as funny little games, or say that his knife's so nice and sharp. Really, this all points to someone who knows how to use language and knows the system and wants to get the message out as quickly as possible, rather than giving an individual news organization an exclusive. And when we look at journalism in Victorian England, we find it to be a freewheeling, sensationalistic business in which truth and restraint were often sacrificed in service of a big story. Everyone had a vested interest in the Whitechapel murders. The people of the East End who were the potential targets, the rest of London who had had their confident insular world shaken, the police who had been tested as never before, the government which was increasingly embarrassed, and of course, the press. The Whitechapel murders sold papers and kept journalists employed. How much more mileage could they get out of the Jack the Ripper murders? And it wasn't solely a matter of commerce for the press either. The agenda for some was more complex. As Martin Fido points out, this was the time of the London County Council elections, and the Radicals were attempting to take over the East End and make their mark. The year before, on November 13, 1887, the Metropolitan Police, under the leadership of Sir Charles Warren, had put down a massed demonstration by the unemployed in Trafalgar Square. The event became known as Bloody Sunday. The Whitechapel murders became a ready-made issue for the radical press. The fear generated became a way for them to say, "Look at the conditions here. What is being done? What would be done if this were happening in the West End?" The mainline papers had to pick up the story or be left behind. So the Dear Boss letter, being made public so soon after the double event, helped keep the case in the forefront. Yet I remain in agreement with Assistant Metropolitan Police Commissioner Dr. Robert Anderson and Chief Inspector Donald Swanson, who believed the writer to be an enterprising journalist. In fact, they both believe they knew the identity of the man. And just as significant as any of these considerations is that, like the Yorkshire Ripper almost a century later, this type of unsub would not communicate with the police in this manner. Unlike the organized antisocial type, this individual would not want to proclaim himself this way, particularly not talk about future crimes. This type thinks only of what he is doing at the moment, and he would not have come up with a nickname for himself, particularly such a flamboyant one. In my 25 years of experience, all of the serial offenders who communicated with the press or police and proposed names and identities for themselves leaned much more to the organized antisocial side of the continuum than the disorganized asocial side. I therefore believe that by disseminating the Dear Boss and Saucy Jackie communications, the police and press were actually hindering the investigation, diverting attention away from the real unsub. Now, if you've been paying attention to the case chronology, another important consideration for any investigator or analyst, you may have noticed that the Dear Boss letter was dated September 25th and postmarked September 27th. The double event took place on the night and morning of September 29th to 30th. And the writer does refer to clipping the lady's ears off and send to the police officers just for jolly. Catherine Eddowes' right earlobe was, in fact, sliced off. Was this a lucky guess? Probably. So much was done to Eddowes that the writer could have mentioned just about anything and have been right. If it was the real guy, wouldn't he more likely have mentioned some of the major mutilations he intended to inflict? And of course, he did not send the ear to the police. As far as the timing, arriving just a day before the double event, this again may have turned out to be a lucky guess, but not an uneducated one for someone paying close attention, as an enterprising newspaperman would. The Nichols murder had taken place on a Friday. The Chapman murder had occurred a week later on a Saturday. There had been no murders for the next two weekends, so if one was going to happen at all, the weekend of September 28th, 29th would be a likely time. Also, with no murders in that stretch of time, the story was starting to get cold, so if you wanted to revive it, this would be the moment. The Saucy Jackie postcard then, which was posted on October 1st, was an attempt to catch up with what had actually happened and authenticate the first communication. The double event this time, number one squealed a bit, couldn't finish straight off. People believe what they want to believe. And for a public anxious to know the monster they were dealing with, this was just the kind of authentication they needed. Of course, in one important sense, the Dear Boss letter became a real and self-actualizing part of the case. Because even if the communication was not authentic, it ensured that this series of crimes would be immortalized. Without the Jack the Ripper identity, I doubt whether this offender would have so captured history and the public imagination. From Hell. The frenzy was still intense. In addition to the stepped-up police patrols, locals had formed their own protective organizations. The most highly visible was probably the Whitechapel Vigilance Committee, which was headed by George Aiken Lusk, a builder who specialized in the restoration of music halls. Lusk attained a high profile for himself by writing about the case in the Times. On October 16th, Lusk received a package in the mail, a small cardboard box wrapped in brown paper and bearing a London postmark. In the box was half a kidney, soaked in wine to preserve it. Wrapped around the kidney was a crudely written letter. From Hell. Mr. Lusk, sore. I send you half the kidney I took from one woman, preserved it for you. T'other piece I fried and ate, it was very nice. I may send you the bloody knife that took it out, if you only wait a while longer. Signed, Catch Me When You Can, Mr. Lusk. Lusk assumed the organ and letter to be a hoax, possibly by a medical student or a group of students with easy access to an anatomy lab. But he was persuaded by friends to hand it over to authorities for analysis. Dr. Thomas Openshaw of London Hospital believed it to be human, and from an individual of about 45 and suffering from Bright's disease, not an inconsistent finding in a chronic alcoholic. A number of other experts had a chance to examine the kidney with mixed opinions as to its authenticity in the Eddowes murder. That authenticity, however, has never been ruled out, and much of the scholarship over the years suggests that the kidney may actually have belonged to the victim. I can't speak to the forensic likelihood of the kidneys having come from Catherine Eddowes's body, but the accompanying letter is certainly intriguing. Despite the apparent differences in handwriting, possibly attributed to an increasingly fragmented psyche, many of the ripperologists and other students of the case who believe the Dear Boss and Saucy Jackie communications to be authentic believe the same of the Lusk letter, and vice versa. I'm not so sure. Handwriting experts are divided on the matter, so I can't rely on them for help. I think it is highly significant that even after the frenzy created by the Jack the Ripper pseudonym, the writer of the Lusk letter does not use it. Even after he is tagged with such a glamorous title, he does not take it on himself. Since I believe the Boss and Jackie letters to be fakes, I'm intrigued by the possibilities for this one. Though I said I didn't believe this type of offender would feel the need to communicate with the public, it is possible that the Boss letter, especially arriving so soon after the double event, may have compelled the disorganized killer to come out and set the record straight, to keep control, as it were. He may have sent the piece of kidney to authenticate himself after the ear mention in Dear Boss. In other words, he wouldn't have felt a need to communicate until someone else claimed credit and tried to define his personality and identity for him. His own sense of identity and emotional orientation is more accurately portrayed by where he says the letter is coming from. From hell. The style of the writing itself is virtually an illiterate parody of the cleverer and more sophisticated style of the first letter, as if the writer is trying unsuccessfully to show himself equal to the wit and flair of the pretender. I might add that Donald Rumbelow, a former police officer, a gifted author, and one of the greatest experts on the case, agrees with the assessment that of all the communications, the Lusk letter is the only one likely to be genuine. Some of the letter's critics claim that the spelling, sore, presarved, mister, suggests stage Irish dialect, in other words, an educated person's attempt to sound colloquial. Although that's possible, to me the spelling suggests someone not terribly familiar with English writing, most likely an uneducated immigrant, who is writing it the way he hears it. That the letter was sent not to the police, not to the press, but to a local ad hoc community leader is also significant, because I believe strongly that this type of disorganized offender is going to be operating only within his own circumscribed zone of comfort. This is a concept we'll develop in more detail shortly. It's also not beyond the realm of possibility that a disorganized offender who, we've already established, has a perverse sense of curiosity about the inside of the human body, might try to satisfy that curiosity by eating some of it. And as to the closing salutation, catch me when you can, that can have two meanings. One would be an obvious taunt to the police from someone who has found that he can repeatedly get away with murder. The other would be a cry for help, similar to the, "For heaven's sake, catch me before I kill more, I cannot control myself," message scrawled on a wall by Chicago murderer William Hirons with his victim's lipstick. One of Hirons's other victims, a 6-year-old girl, was found cut up in pieces in a suburban sewer. Could I be mistaken about the authenticity of the Lusk letter? Sure. A lot of the experts disagree with me. But what I can say is that unlike the communications that came before it, this one is consistent with what I would expect from the type of unsub I suspect Jack the Ripper to have been. Proactive ideas. There was much speculation about the best way to catch this elusive and unprecedented killer, some of it from ordinary citizens, some from experts. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, whose first Sherlock Holmes novel, A Study in Scarlet, had been published the previous year, speculated that the killer might be a man disguised as a woman. A midwife walking around Whitechapel in the early morning hours with a bloody apron would arouse little suspicion. A few years later, in 1894, Conan Doyle suggested to an interviewer how Holmes would have attempted to crack the case. One of his techniques would have been to reproduce the Dear Boss letter and invite the public to respond. This is a highly legitimate proactive technique, which Special Agent Jana Monroe of my unit used successfully in the Rogers murder case in Florida, when a billboard reproduction of the killer's handwriting led to a swift ID. To give the Metropolitan Police their due, however, they did reproduce the Dear Boss letter on posters that were placed throughout the East End, but the technique came to nothing. As I don't believe the letter to be authentic, I'm not surprised. One newspaper reader, as described by Donald Rumbelow in his landmark Jack the Ripper, The Complete Casebook, suggested in a letter that police search the Saucy Jackie postcard. Since no two persons' thumbs are alike, the impression of one suspected person's thumb should be taken and microscopically examined. Rumbelow reports that the letter was filed away and that it would be 17 years before the first fingerprint conviction. When the press began circulating the idea that the killer could be a depraved doctor or medical student, Rumbelow writes how one person suggested placing the following advertisement in newspapers the Ripper might see. Medical man or assistant wanted in London, aged between 25 and 40. Must not object to assist in occasional post-mortem. Liberal terms. Although I do not believe the Ripper to have been a medical man, he certainly had the curiosity, and this is the kind of ploy that might just have brought him out. Dr. Forbes Winslow, a flamboyant physician and amateur detective, who believed the killer to be a homicidal maniac goaded on by a religious mania, suggested having wardens from lunatic asylums patrolling with the police, since they would be much more likely to recognize such tendencies in an individual. He also proposed a newspaper advertisement reading, "A gentleman who is strongly opposed to the presence of fallen women in the streets of London would like to cooperate with someone with a view to their suppression." The police would then gather in hiding at the prearranged meeting place and grab whoever showed up. Black Mary. On the morning of Friday, November 9th, Thomas Bowyer, an Indian Army retiree known to friends and neighbors as Indian Harry, was dispatched by his boss, local merchant John McCarthy, to collect rent at a house he owned at 13 Miller's Court. It was almost right next to Spitalfields Market, and a short walk from both Goulston Street to the south and Hanbury Street, site of the Chapman murder, to the northeast. With the kinds of tenants who lived in such buildings as McCarthy's, collecting the rent was a regular ordeal for both landlord and renter. The entrance to Miller's Court was a narrow, dingy passageway next to McCarthy's candle shop. Bowyer knocked on the door of Mary Jane Kelly, also said to have been known as Ginger, Fair Emma, and Black Mary to her various friends and clients. She was a streetwise 24-year-old Irish girl and by most accounts was quite pretty, though no photographs of her are known. It was about 10:45 in the morning when Bowyer called on her, a good time to find her in. He knocked several times without response, and began to suspect she didn't have the rent money and was avoiding him. He tried without success to spring the lock, but there was a long broken window pane that had never been fixed. Inside it, an old coat had been hung in place of a proper curtain for some measure of privacy. He pushed aside the coat and peered in. The room was only 10 by 12 feet, and the sight that met Thomas Bowyer's eyes was one of such unmitigated horror that he was virtually paralyzed. A body was lying on the bed, but it was so mutilated, so torn apart, with so much of the flesh ripped off and the insides strewn across the bed and onto the floor, that the dimensions of the body, the outlines of its form, could no longer be discerned. When the hideous sight had finally registered in his brain, Bowyer raced down to McCarthy's shop. McCarthy went back up with Bowyer, glanced at the broken window himself, then immediately dispatched Bowyer to the Commercial Street police station. He returned with Inspector Walter Beck and Detective Constable Walter Dew. Dew was a tough straight shooter known as Blue Surge because of the suit he wore habitually. He would go on to fame as the detective who caught the notorious poisoner, Dr. Hawley Harvey Crippen. But the image he saw at 13 Miller's Court was so emotionally harrowing that it haunted him the rest of his life. Since this was the first indoor scene where good evidence could be collected, a conscientious effort not to disturb it was made, and not until 1:30 p.m., when Superintendent Thomas Arnold arrived, was the door finally broken in. The bed and surrounding area were saturated with blood. The body, as described by Dr. George Baxter Phillips, showed what had to be the final escalation of the killer's homicidal, mutilating frenzy. The face was cut apart, and the head just about severed. The breasts had been cut off, abdomen ripped open, and the internal organs thrown about the room. Much of the remaining body, including the pubic area, right thigh, and right buttock, had had the flesh removed down to the bone. The heart was missing from the scene. Not only had the killer attempted to de-sex this victim, he'd gone all the way to dehumanize, to depersonalize her. Some of the doctors who either visited the scene or studied the body in autopsy estimated that the mutilation had taken as long as 2 hours, though the cause of death, the severing of the carotid artery, had taken place far sooner. It is difficult for normal people to conceive of an act this depraved as a sexual fantasy, but our research shows that it is. Part of the fantasy is destroying the victim to the extent that the offender feels that he becomes her sole possessor. The mutilation murderer James Clayton Lawson Jr., who teamed up with rapist James Russell Odom, whom he met in California's Atascadero State Mental Hospital, explained his 1970s killings of young women whom Odom had just raped with forthright candor. "Then I cut her throat so she would not scream. I wanted to cut her body so she would not look like a person, and destroy her so she would not exist. I began to cut on her body. I remember cutting her breasts off. After this, all I remember is that I kept cutting on her body." When pressed about the details of his involvement with the victim, as distinguished from Odom's, Lawson insisted, "I did not rape the girl. I only wanted to destroy her." This, I think, is what investigators were seeing at 13 Miller's Court. Inspector Frederick Aberline arrived and inspected the room. He concluded from the smoldering remains in the fireplace that the killer had burned clothing in there, as well as using the flames for illumination for his work. For about a year before the murder, Mary Jane Kelly had been living on and off with a Billingsgate Market fish porter named Joseph Barnett. Life with him wasn't uniformly harmonious. In July 1888, he'd lost his job because of theft, and at the end of October, he'd moved out of the room they shared because Mary had invited another prostitute to share the premises. He did, however, continue to visit her almost daily, sometimes giving her small amounts of money. There are also stories that he wanted her to get out of the street trade. He last saw her between about 7:30 and 8 on the evening of Thursday, November 8th, when he came by the room. Mary was in the company of her friend, Lizzie Albrook. Around 11, someone thought they saw her in the Britannica pub with a young man. About 45 minutes later, Mary Cox, another prostitute who lived in Miller's Court, saw Mary with a different man, with a blotchy face, mustache, and hat. She was noticeably drunk. Between 12 and 1, several other Miller's Court residents heard her singing. At 2, she approached George Hutchinson, an unemployed laborer whom she knew, and asked for a loan of sixpence. Hutchinson was broke, so had to turn her down. Hutchinson saw her approached by another man as she walked away, and they were both laughing. He thought he heard the man say something like, "You will be all right for what I have told you." Hutchinson couldn't see the man's face, but followed the pair back to Miller's Court. He heard Mary say, "All right, my dear, come along. You will be comfortable." Approximately 3:45 a.m. on Friday morning, three women in Miller's Court thought they heard a scream of, "Oh, murder," from the direction of number 13. If it was Mary Kelly who uttered that scream, they would have been the last words she ever spoke. Joseph Barnett was subjected to 4 hours of intense questioning by the police. They took his clothing and examined it for bloodstains and other clues. They were satisfied he was not the killer. Recently, however, he has again emerged as a suspect, most prominently in the work of Bruce Paley, whose book, Jack the Ripper, The Simple Truth, was published in 1995. The theory is that he murdered the other women to scare Mary into giving up prostitution, and that he finally killed her in a mad frenzy when it became clear that she had tired of him and would not take him back. During his interrogation by police, Barnett admitted that he frequently read Mary newspaper accounts of the Whitechapel murders. This theory offers an explanation of why the murders stopped, because they did with Kelly's death. Proponents of Barnett's candidacy also point out that he was skilled with knives, had some rudimentary knowledge of anatomy, was a local who felt comfortable in the area and could therefore probably approach local hookers without alarming them, and generally fits the eyewitness descriptions. Barnett would obviously have easy access to Kelly's room, and it could be more than coincidental that the Dear Boss letter mentions ginger beer bottles, and such bottles were found in the room. Paley also cites the analysis I did at the time of the 1988 television series, as well as more general research about serial predators that has come out of my unit at Quantico, in showing how Barnett fits the profile. This could be true in certain ways: age, race, dysfunctional childhood with no father, comfort zone, triggering emotional events such as the loss of his job, for example. but these are the superficial characteristics, true of a lot of people. They're almost boilerplate for a certain type of offender. You have to get into the specifics to see if it really fits. And I have never seen, nor do I believe someone would, in this manner, brutally kill women he knows, even vaguely, to scare his own partner and teach her a lesson. Particularly, on the night of the double event, a guy of this type would have been scared off by the first one. He would never have gone after Liz Stride. The motive just doesn't work. Yes, there are sexual sadists who get off by torturing women, but the mutilation here is all post-mortem, so that doesn't fit. Also, these are not planned, considered kills. They're frenzied, out-of-control overkills. If the perpetrator were someone with a personal relationship with the victim, we might expect to see some kind of overkill in stabbing or wounds to the face, but not this kind of ritual mutilation. There's no pattern or internal logic to it. No one who has had a relatively normal relationship with a woman, as Barnett evidently did, could perpetrate this kind of crime. So if it wasn't Joseph Barnett, who would have had no reason to go on killing after Mary Kelly's death, and would have been sufficiently scared by the police interrogation to keep his nose clean the rest of his life, why did the Ripper murders stop after Friday, November 9, 1888? That, of course, is one of the most tantalizing mysteries of the case. Our research and experience in the Bureau shows that serial sexual predators stop for one of several key reasons, and burnout is generally not one of them. On rare occasions, an offender will have accomplished what he set out to do emotionally and will cease on his own. One such example would be Edmund Kemper, who abducted and murdered a series of co-eds around the campus of the University of California, Santa Cruz in the early 1970s. His rage against women was actually directed at his domineering, hectoring mother, and eventually he got up the guts to bludgeon her to death in her sleep with a claw hammer, decapitate her, rape her headless corpse, then tear out her larynx and jam it down the garbage disposal. He then called his mother's best friend, and when she arrived at the house, he clubbed and strangled her to death. Having exorcised this demon from his system, he had a good night's sleep in his mother's bed, then drove to Pueblo, Colorado, where he called the Santa Cruz police from a phone booth and told them to come and get him. But, as I say, such self-limiting killers are rare. More often, serial predators stop for one of three reasons. They're caught and put on ice for something else, such as a break-in or robbery but not linked to their predatory crimes, or they die while committing a crime by the hand of an associate or other offender, by suicide, or by some other natural cause. Or they don't really stop. They merely get scared out of a particular location and move on to another where their previous crimes are not linked. Were any of these likely in the Ripper case? Let's take a look at the profile to see if it gives us any suggestions. The profile. Victimology. All of the victims were street prostitutes with moderate to severe drinking problems. Both of these facts create high-risk victims, which makes it difficult to develop suspects. If any evidence such as hair and fibers or semen were obtained from the victim, even if such techniques had been available in 1888, investigators would not know for certain if it came from the subject or some other partner or customer. And since these prostitutes were independent, not controlled by pimps as so many are today, there would be little monitoring of their activities and transactions. That is to say that even more so than today, a female prostitute who drank heavily and then plied the already dangerous East End streets was looking for trouble. Notwithstanding the Barnett theory and certain of the other conspiracy theories, all reasonable evidence suggests that the victims were targeted because they were readily accessible. The offender did not have to initiate the contact. With the exception of the last victim, Mary Kelly, the others were relatively old, beaten down by life, and fairly unattractive. They would have initiated the contact. These are all important investigative considerations. Medical examination. The critical findings for a behavioral analysis are 1. No evidence of sexual assault. 2. Subject killed victims swiftly. 3. Subject was able to maintain control of victims during the initial blitz-style attack. 4. Subject removed body organs from some of the victims, indicating some anatomical knowledge or curiosity. 5. No evidence of physical torture prior to death. 6. Severe postmortem mutilation. 7. Evidence of manual strangulation. 8. In most cases, blood was concentrated in small areas. 9. Rings were taken from one of the victims. 10. The last victim was killed indoors and was the most mutilated. Subject spent considerable time at the scene. 11. Time of death in all cases was in the early morning hours. Crime and crime scene analysis. With the exception of Kelly's murder, all of the crimes were committed outdoors and all within an easy walk of each other. This makes the crimes high risk for the unsub, since these are areas that are often populated around the clock, particularly in the warmer weather months before winter. The bodies of the four outside victims were all discovered within minutes with no attempt to hide them. This in itself is indicative of a disorganized killer. All of the homicides occurred either on Friday, Saturday, or Sunday early morning hours. After the first homicide on Bucks Row near Whitechapel Station, the subject moves slightly across town to the west. If a line is drawn from crime scenes 2, 3, 4, and 5, a triangular configuration is formed. This has been observed in other types of serial crimes, and the triangle is viewed as a secondary comfort zone for the unsub. This movement is caused when a subject believes that the investigation is heating up in his primary comfort zone, which in this case would be the location of the first homicide, in the vicinity of Whitechapel Station. It's my opinion that there were other attacks in the Whitechapel area that either went unreported or, for some reason, were not considered to be crimes of this offender. If, for instance, the Martha Tabram murder, which occurred not on a weekend but a bank holiday Monday, another non-work day, is considered a possible ripper crime, we should note that it occurred just outside this secondary comfort zone, but to the west. I could make the case that the offender then went eastward for his next kill before moving gradually back to the area in which he felt most comfortable. Though the modus operandi evolves with the serial predator, the signature or ritual aspect remains in place, often becoming more elaborate over time, as was the case with the final victim. Here, the subject had the time and the privacy to fully act out his fantasies. If there were to be further murders then, particularly if they were outdoors, we would not expect the subject to engage in such elaborate mutilation. He would not have the time. Communications allegedly received from the subject. It is unusual for a serial killer of the disorganized asocial type to communicate with the police, media, family, etc. When they do, they generally provide specifics about the crime that are known only by the subject. In addition, they generally provide information about their motive for committing such heinous crimes. In my opinion, this series of homicides was not perpetrated by someone who set up a challenge against law enforcement. While the killer knew he would be receiving national and international publicity, this was not his primary motivation. If time and law enforcement resources were to be expended on the identity of the author or authors of the communications, emphasis should have been placed on the Lusk letter. Offender traits and characteristics. As noted earlier, these homicides may be classified as lust murders. This has less to do with the traditional meaning of the word than with the fact that the subject attacks the genital and sexually oriented areas of the body. Generally, when male victims are attacked in this fashion, they have been involved in homosexual relationships. Though it has been speculated that the offender could be a woman, Jill the Ripper, I have never experienced a female serial lust murderer either in research or cases we've received at Quantico. We can therefore state with confidence that Jack the Ripper was, in fact, a male. He was white, since these crimes tend to be intra-racial, and since a black, Hispanic, or Asian would have stood out at the crime locations. The age of onset for these types is generally between the mid to late 20s and early 30s. Based upon the high degree of psychopathology exhibited at the scene, and his ability to avoid detection despite the high-risk nature of the crimes, the age of the subject is around 28 to 36, However, it should be noted that age is a difficult characteristic to categorize, and consequently we would not eliminate a viable suspect exclusively because of age. For example, though we were correct on all other significant traits, we underestimated the age of a serial killer of prostitutes in Rochester, New York in the late 1980s. The subject, Arthur Shawcross, had been in prison for 15 years on charges of child assault and murder. When he got out, he merely picked up where he'd left off. Jack would not look out of the ordinary. In my initial profile, I suggested that the clothing he wore at the time of the assaults would not be his everyday dress, as he would want to project to unsuspecting females that he had money, so he wouldn't have to initiate contact. But experts on the era have since informed me that, unlike most of the modern prostitutes that I have encountered in crime investigation, the Victorian East End prostitutes were so desperate they would have approached anyone, regardless of dress. In fact, after the rumors surfaced that Jack might have been a medical doctor, they could have been even warier of a well-dressed and decidedly out-of-place customer. I would expect this unsub to have come from a family with a domineering mother and weak, passive, and/or absent father. In all likelihood, his mother drank heavily and enjoyed the company of many men. As a result, he failed to receive consistent care and contact with stable adult role models, and became detached socially with a diminished emotional response toward others. He became asocial, preferring to be alone. His anger became internalized, and in his younger years, he expressed his pent-up destructive emotions by setting fires and mistreating or torturing small animals. By perpetrating these acts, he discovered increased areas of dominance, power, and control, and learned how to continue violent destructive acts without detection or punishment. As he grew older, his fantasy developed a strong component that included domination and mutilation of women, along with a basic curiosity about them unfulfilled in his real life. For employment, he would have sought a position where he could work alone and vicariously experience his destructive fantasies. If he were capable of such work, this might include employment as a butcher, mortician's helper, hospital or morgue attendant. If employed, he'd have been off work on the weekends and holidays. He was paranoid and carried one or more knives with him in case of attack. This paranoid-type thinking would have been in part justified because of his poor self-image. He might have had some physical abnormality, scarring, or speech problem that he perceived as psychologically crippling. He was not adept at meeting people socially, and most of his relationships would have been with prostitutes. Due to the lack of hygiene practices by street prostitutes at the time and the absence of treatment for venereal diseases, he may have been infected, which would have further fueled his hatred and disgust for women. We would not expect this type of offender to have been married or to have carried on a normal relationship with a woman. If he had been married in the past, it would have been to someone older than himself, and the marriage would have been brief. He would have been perceived as a quiet, shy loner, slightly withdrawn, obedient, and fairly neat and orderly in appearance. He may have drunk in the local pubs, at which point he may have become more relaxed and found it easier to engage in conversation. He lived or worked in the Whitechapel area, and the first homicide would have been close to either his home or workplace. Note that London Hospital is only one block from the Nichols murder. The police might well have interviewed him more than once during the investigation. Unfortunately, at this time, there is no way to correlate this type of information. Investigators and citizens in the community had a preconceived idea of what Jack the Ripper would look like. Because of the belief that he would appear odd or ghoulish, they could have looked right past this individual. Pre- and post-offense behavior. Prior to each homicide, the subject was in a local pub drinking and lowering his inhibitions. He would have been observed walking all over the Whitechapel area during the early evening hours. He did not seek a certain look in a woman. However, it was no accident that he killed prostitutes. He had the sense to know when and where to attack his victims. Many other women would have come in contact with this subject but were not assaulted because the location was not secure enough. Post-offense behavior would have included returning to an area where he could wash his hands of blood and remove his clothing. Unlike more organized offenders, we would not expect him to have injected himself into the police investigation or to have provided bogus information. Jack hunted nightly for his victims. When he could not find another, he would have returned to the locations of previous kills. If marked grave sites were accessible to him, he might have visited them in the early morning hours to relive the experience of his crimes. This subject would not have committed suicide after the last homicide. It would also be surprising for him to suddenly stop on his own, without some outside cause. Investigative and/or prosecutorial techniques. If the suspect had been apprehended, I would have recommended interviewing him in the early morning hours when he would have felt most relaxed and likely to talk or write about his motivation for killing women. He would not have been visibly shaken or upset if directly accused of the homicides, because he believed they were justified in removing garbage from the streets. He would, however, have been psychologically and physiologically stressed if confronted with the fact that he became personally soiled by the victim's blood. He would not have tried to outwit interrogators, but might have become frustrated by their inability to understand why he took the actions he did. The suspects. It would be at this point, in a typical investigation, after I'd presented my profile and suggestions, that we'd consider the local investigator's list of suspects. We've dealt with John Pizer, the alleged leather apron, and Joseph Barnett, Mary Kelly's sometime live-in companion. Presented with these two, I could easily have eliminated them, Pizer on alibi and Barnett on motive. So who else was there? Well, there were plenty, and more as the years and decades went by, and greater numbers of people from all over the world became interested in, then obsessed by this case. The search for Jack the Ripper's identity has become like the speculation over who really wrote Shakespeare's plays. It has become a Rorschach test that often reveals more about the beholder than the subject beheld. But let's take a look. Prince Eddie. Perhaps the most intriguing suspect is Prince Albert Victor Christian Edward, Duke of Clarence and Avondale, son of Albert Edward, Prince of Wales, later Edward VII, and grandson of Queen Victoria. I mean, what could be more fascinating than a suspect from the highest, most powerful family in the world? I can tell you that having spent 25 years investigating and chasing the lowest of the lowlifes, if a local cop brought me a suspect like him, it would sure get my attention. I should point out here, though, that this theory never came up during the actual Ripper investigation. In fact, it didn't surface until the early 1960s, so I'm somewhat skeptical going in. Known as Prince Eddie, the 28-year-old was second in line of succession to the throne. This theory has it that the prince, never known as the brightest light or most upstanding exemplar of the Hanover line, suffered from effects of syphilis on the brain as a result of his debauching, and that he used to slum in Whitechapel and pick up lowly women. The dementia caused him to kill some of these women for sport, and as a deer hunter, he had the skill to disembowel his victims. Once operatives at Buckingham Palace learned what was going on, they had him put away under the supervision of royal physician Sir William Gull until he died of pneumonia in January of 1892. An alternate theory has Gull either dispatching him himself or supervising his euthanasia when it became clear he was too great a liability to the crown. His fiancée, Princess Mary of Teck, was then betrothed to his younger brother. Together, those two went on to become King George V and Queen Mary. Another variation of the story has Prince Eddie frequenting homosexual brothels in the East End and conducting the murders as a manifestation of his mad hatred and fear of women. Still a third narrative, in many ways the most interesting, suggests that Eddie secretly married Annie Elizabeth Crook and had a baby girl by her. Since Annie was not only a poor, lower-class woman but also a Catholic, by law, members of the royal family could not marry outside the Church of England and still maintain their station and place in the line of succession, this would have been a huge scandal that would have shaken the very foundations of the monarchy. Operatives of the crown picked up Annie, spirited her off to a lunatic asylum. Who there could possibly believe such a low-born girl's claim of marriage to the Prince of Wales' son, and figured they'd suppress the problem. But there was a complication, as there always is. The baby's nursemaid, Mary Jane Kelly, spilled the beans to some of her friends, Polly Nichols, Annie Chapman, Liz Stride, and Kate Eddowes, and tried to blackmail the government with what she knew. It was then necessary to eliminate all of these people to keep the story quiet. This is where Sir William Gull comes in again. It was his responsibility, with his obvious medical knowledge, to venture out into the East End with a driver and henchman, find the women, and kill them. Gull, a Freemason, employed the ritualistic punishment meted out to the Jews as a warning to others who would interfere. Okay, there are a number of problems with all of the Prince Eddie theories. For one, and this has nothing to do with profiling, the prince can be alibied for each of the murders by eyewitness accounts and the myriad royal diaries and court circulars. Sure, it's possible for a prince to duck out of sight, but not in situations where he's being seen by scores or hundreds of people. A second problem, even apart from the fact that absolutely no contemporary or historical evidence supports the claim against the prince, is that no one who could commit these kinds of crimes, particularly the frenzied butchery of Mary Jane Kelly, could continue functioning and interacting with people in a relatively normal way. Someone would have noticed something, and it would not have stayed a secret. These are the crimes of an individual who does not know how to interact with women, and whatever his personal hang-ups or character flaws, Prince Albert Edward would have been trained to this social grace. Moreover, to me, these crimes are the work of a disorganized, paranoid offender. I cannot conceive of the killer, particularly the prince, planning the crimes to the point of venturing into a foreign neighborhood with great risk of being recognized with the intended purpose of mutilating women he'd never met. The same logic applies to Dr. Gull, who, in addition, was more than 70 years old and had had a stroke. We face conspiracy theories over and over again in criminology, and the royal conspiracy theory will probably continue to attract attention as long as interest in the Ripper murders remains. Conspiracy theories are